it up as I go. Tell you what, I'm kind of in the mood to play a little bit of Axis and Allies.
Yeah.
A bit of Risk, Battleship even.
Yeah.
I might turn into one of those guys who's just really into military tactics.
You know what? I'm all for it. Axis and Allies is a fantastic name for a board game.
I know. I could never get into it. I had friends in high school who
were. I was about to say the same thing. It was too complicated for me.
I loved Risk. It's not like I wasn't a dork. I couldn't grasp. It was a little too complex for me.
Can I admit I played Risk earlier this week with my wife? It was the Game of Thrones version.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. Got it for Christmas a couple of years ago.
Do you like those?
Versions? I kind of prefer the original, but this is pretty fun.
I got the maps on the original down. I got the maps. I like to really try to get either Africa or South America right off the bat to get those guys coming in. Mm. And I just don't know if I'd be able to, like, what's the equivalent, like, in the Southlands in Game of Thrones or in the Lord of the Rings version. It's like, I gotta lock down Mordor. I don't know.
There's actually two maps. You can get a two-player map or the 3-5-player map. Which is a two-player map earlier this week. But yeah, you feel like a tactician. You're like, where should my troop movements be? And you think about it, and you're like, that's pretty solid. And then,
that's what I mean. It's been fun.
Why'd you bring that up, Matt?
Well, we're about to do an interview with a World War II historian.
There you go.
And I just finished the book. It really is fantastic. We've already recorded the interview. We're doing this right after.
Magic of podcasting.
I didn't want it to be weird. Like, I didn't want to just shower him with praise. He seemed like the type of guy who's a humble guy. He didn't want to. But it was really a very fascinating, very good book. And the whole last half was kind of the steps leading up to the Battle of Midway and then what actually happened. And I'm kind of into that now. My 40s might have to be just really geeking out on military tactics.
Yeah, because in the book, Diplomats and Admirals, and you'll listen to the interview after this intro, but he is really good at the details of, like, there's so many small details that go into it. And you see in the book, like, with the Japanese admiral who decides to, like, change ammunitions, like, in the middle of the battle, and it's like, and then it reverses course. Like, there's so many little details that have a huge effect that obviously, you know, probably can't be taught in school because they're just kind of the minutia of battle, but it's all those little details that it's fascinating. It's like also like, so many things could go wrong, or just like kind of luck can happen. So
just all that stuff. And I thought it was well told in the book. You get like, I'm not an expert on the big heavy machinery and the tactics and how you use planes and the importance of carriers, or I wasn't beforehand. And now, like, having read the book, it's like, I kind of get it now. I'm not an expert, but it was kind of fascinating to me. He laid it out very well.
I didn't say this in the interview, but I want to gain your, like, if you understand this point I'm going to make. Like, a great history book or good history book for me is I learn something, and then after I get done reading it, I want to continue to read about some of the people in the book or the events. Like, that to me is like, oh, I've learned a lot, but it kind of like scratches an itch, and I kind of want to get more, even if the book covers everything really well. And that's what this book did. It made me want to seek out historical figures that I didn't know, like, their importance before, or books about naval battles in World War II. So if that's the kind of history book you like, which I think most people like, kind of like informs you and you want to read more, that the book we had with the interview with Dale Jenkins, his book does both those things for me. So that's high praise from us, right?
I'm with you. I'm interested in the Pacific Theater naval battles now. Like, for unironically, I really, it's fascinating. I want to know more about Midway. I want to know know more about what happened before. The book, it raises a lot of, I love a good historical what if, and there are so many of them. I mean, we get into it in the interview a bit. Like, I'd always seen Pearl Harbor as halfway inevitable. We came really close to a settlement with Japan. Like, it almost didn't happen. Like, the Japanese would have backed down had they accepted this settlement. It was just, the world looks totally different if there's a settled peace with Japan. America can just fight the European theater. I mean, what is Vietnam look like? What does the Soviet Union look like? Japan still has a presence in Manchuria. Japan could conceivably still have an emperor to this day. It was just, no, just a hair, like, just so close to happening.
Because I was thinking while reading the book, so if there is kind of like a peace broker between the United States and Japan before, like, the, you know, I think obviously the United States is going to get involved in Europe at some point. But, like, is there a conflict later on, like the 50s? How does the geopolitical sense, it's kind of unanswerable, really, but yeah. It is fascinating to think about. Because you and I growing up, my dad would always be like, oh, I think, you know, Roosevelt knew that Pearl kind of like wanted to get into war, but you don't really realize all the kind of diplomacy back channel stuff that was working towards. People were working towards this agreement that was kind of on the table and then last second sort of fell apart and along the way kind of got, but no, fascinating topic.
It's detailed really well in the book, like why things fell apart. Like, some of it reads like a thriller where you know what's going to happen, but you're kind of fascinated by the progressions. Factions for the United States and Japan both wanted peace. You know, it could have happened. It just kind of, for whatever reason, fell apart. Oh, and that's another thing. The whole, like, Roosevelt knew. Like, he wouldn't have. Nobody knew. Even people who wanted to get into a war and wanted Japan to strike first, there's no way they knew it was going to be Pearl Harbor. It was too far away.
To be honest, there was a warning, though, from earlier, and it's in the book, from
James. He's ignored.
And I bring it up in the interview, and the ambassador group says, you know, there's been talk that Japan's looking to, you know, attack.
If they feel cornered, they're going to attack Pearl Harbor. Yeah.
And it was kind of like, okay. And then they never really.
The guy literally says, if Japan feels they have no other choice, they're probably going to attack Pearl Harbor. And that's just in the memo. And they totally ignore it. But I guess we don't get to it in the interview, but in the book, he talks about how when the cable started coming in, the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. Some of the people, the Americans getting the cables, were like, they must be the Philippines. There's no way they traveled as far as Hawaii. So, it's all in the book. It's all very,
and it's like, it was a great interview. I think it was. Hopefully everyone liked it. I think we're both big history fans or nonfiction fans, so maybe this will spur us to do more nonfiction on the podcast. And hopefully, if people like that, let us know if you want us to read more history or biography, because I think we both have, there's certain subjects that we like to explore. Maybe down the line we get some more nonfiction on the podcast.
I'd like to.
Because I haven't told you this, but my library, you know, my trials of putting it on hold, large numbers of library books. Mm-hmm. I just picked up from the library, I think you'll find this interesting, a 800 page biography of J. Edgar Hoover that just came out. There's about a 5% chance I finish it in the time allotted to me by the library, but I read 30 pages and I learned a little bit about J. Edgar Hoover's childhood. So if we do go down that nonfiction route, there's some good, we can get in some good subjects there.
Well, I guess, and if you're waiting for the once and future king in Life and Fate.
Hey, before we go to the interview, we do have, you know, we are still reading those books that we put on our TBR. We're still going to do those episodes. So don't get, you can get frustrated with us, but don't get dispirited. Maybe be dispirited. I don't know.
Don't be. Yeah, don't be dispiriting.
But we have a lot of good books on the way. We have our thriller corner over on our Patreon that we started up with a new selection, Slow Horses. So if you like and want to support us, you can hear content over there where we discuss. We've done a couple over there with thrillers. And then once the baseball season starts, head into some more baseball books. So that's over on our Patreon. So that's kind of a look ahead for the podcast. Matt, anything else before we kind of cut to the interview with Dale Jenkins?
Let me just come in with a smooth segue to the interview. Now, prepare yourself for one of the better interviews we've ever done on this podcast with the author of Diplomats and Admirals, Dale A. Jenkins. All right. We have with us Dale Jenkins, the author of the new book, Diplomats and Admirals, which is kind of a chronicle of the kind of failed diplomacy between the United States and Japan leading up to World War II, all the way up through the Battle of Midway. And I guess I wanted to start with, how did this book, this project come about for you?
It came about, well, I was an officer in the Navy, and I was something of a student of naval history. And I focused on the Battle of Midway because it seemed to me that this was an underappreciated victory. It really was the turning point of World War II in the Pacific and had heavy implications for the entire war. And so from there, I started working backward through the naval battles, Coral Sea, got to Pearl Harbor, and then I started thinking about what happened before that got us into this whole war. And that took me into the preceding months, and even with some background all the way back to Franklin D. Roosevelt as a young student, and the background of Admiral Yamamoto in the Battle of Tsushima in 1905. But going all the way back to Midway, we have to realize, it's important to realize, that for the first 8 or 9 months of the war, starting with December of 41 with Pearl Harbor, all the way to August of 42 when the first troops landed at Guadalcanal, this was entirely a Navy war. The United States was at war, but we had no way to land any troops anywhere. It was entirely Navy in the Pacific through the carrier battles that Halsey and the other executed, Marcus, Marshall Islands, the Doolittle Raid, so forth. All that and leading to Coral Sea and Midway, and also in the Atlantic, fighting the U-boats. We had no way to land any troops anywhere. And I think this is something that people haven't really focused on to the extent that is justified.
Kind of going back to the diplomacy aspect, I found fascinating. You were kind of, in the preface of the book, you're kind of going into detail how there's like miscommunication, no communication between sort of the military aspect and the civilian sort of policy rulers. I was kind of surprised to learn the military wasn't pushing for war in the Pacific. They kind of felt like it seemed like you were saying they didn't feel ready, but it was mostly, you know, Hull and some of the cabinet members were kind of pushing for it. Was that surprising to learn or kind of delve into to see that kind of disconnect between the two sides going into the war?
Yes, it very much so. And the military saw the major threat as being Hitler, mm-hmm, and Nazi Germany. And we were just in the process of rearming. And because of that, they saw that we couldn't really be divided very effectively for between the Atlantic and the Pacific. And so the military's position was, and this is General Marshall, the other, and the Navy admirals, they were in effectively saying, whatever you do, don't get into a war with Japan, because we don't have the strength to be in a two-ocean war. We see Hitler as the major threat, and that's what we've got to focus on. So they were trying to delay any involvement in the Pacific. Delay meant different things to different people. Delay meant to the military, we've got to keep our resources focused on Hitler. Delay to really Roosevelt and the cabinet members, Hull, Stimson, so forth, they thought we could just baby Japan along, impose the oil embargo. It was a freezing of assets, but it really became an oil embargo. And we'll force Japan to evacuate from southern Indonesia, in Indochina, and perhaps move them back into evacuating from all of Indochina. And delay for the Japanese meant, if we delay too long, the Americans are rearming, they're getting stronger, the oil embargo is making us weaker, and sooner or later we get strangled. And so before that can happen, we're going to fight. We're going to fight for oil if we have to. And the extreme elements in Japan, which Ambassador Gru warned about, were saying Japan is not going to allow itself to be strangled. They'd rather fight and die than be strangled. Yeah. And so you had delay meaning three different things to three different entities in this whole situation.
Yeah. That's one of the things I notice. Ambassador Gru comes off really well. He seems very prescient in your book. He was warning.
Gru is a tragic hero.
Yeah.
He had the right information. He had the right instincts. He had the right judgments. And he was disregarded, if not really rejected. It's a sad thing.
Yeah, like he was right and no one listened. And you're reading the cables in your book. It does come off as kind of tragic. And didn't you say Hull or Stimson, one of those two, thought he was just naive and, you know, well-meaning, and they just kind of brushed him off?
Well, Stimson was really a guy from an earlier era. You know, I quote him in the book. He was Secretary of State. This is 1929, but it's only about 10 years before. What we're really talking about is in the pre-war era. And he shut down the Code Bureau because he said, gentlemen do not read each other's mail. I mean, what a laughable situation.
Yeah. Correct.
As I said in the book, you know, the foreign ministers all over the world must have just laughed at this. This guy is just totally obsolete.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, and one of the things I found fascinating and one of the things I enjoyed so much about your book was we know what's going to happen in the lead up to Pearl Harbor, just historically. Okay, we know what happens, but the journey there is very tense. It's very suspenseful. I had been under the impression that some sort of conflict between the United States and Japan was inevitable. And it was just about who struck first, but somebody was going to be, you know, the big dog in the Pacific. But it was so close. We were really close to having a settlement with Japan. There were factions with Gru and with us, and it seems like in Japan and Prince Kanoe, is that how you say it? Like a settlement was very, very close to happening that might have prevented war.
Well, Konoe, they say.
kind of way.
The Japanese had come to realize that they, the core elements, the central moderates in Japan, came to realize that they could not win a war against the United States. There had been a significant evaluation done by a group of highly qualified people that spent several months analyzing their economy, comparing it with ours, means of production, resources, military, manpower, the whole thing. They took tours on military bases on Admiral Yamamoto's flagship. They saw exercises, and they compiled their evaluations. They presented to the Japanese cabinet their conclusions. And as I mentioned in Diplomats and Admirals, not in a one-hour meeting, but over 2 days, they reviewed all of their data, all of their methods of evaluation, everything that they had done in great comprehensive detail. And they said that we cannot win a war against the United States, and diplomacy is the only answer. And that convinced Tojo, and this is something that really isn't appreciated. Tojo came around to being, once he was in power, not when he was army minister, but once he was in power, he saw the need to come to a reconciliation with the United States. And that came through the foreign minister that he appointed, and who in turn got a retired diplomat, highly qualified diplomat, Caruso, to make this flying trip across the Pacific to join the negotiations going on in Washington. You know, they held up the eastbound Pan Am Clipper for at least a day in order for him to make the flight. He flew all the way across and got there by the 15th of November.
Yeah, we're talking late November. We almost had a settlement with Japan.
We had an agreement. The Japanese came through and they said, we will withdraw our troops from southern Indochina. And at the same time, the modus vivendi that Hull had drafted, Secretary Hull had drafted, essentially was saying the same thing. Withdraw from the southern half of Indochina. Hull circulated that around to the Chinese, the British, and the Dutch, and said, well, I'd like to get your comments. That in itself was not necessary because the one-on-one, our discussions with the Japanese about the southern part of Indochina was a one-on-one unilateral discussion. Negotiation. So Hull suddenly decided that he should get the approval of these so-called allies, the Dutch, the British, and the Chinese. You know, the British,
that he didn't need.
Churchill was, you know, he had some misgivings. He was concerned about safeguarding Singapore and, you know, he didn't want an agreement where the United States and Japan would have an agreement, but would still leave the British in Singapore exposed to the Japanese. He was concerned about that, but he certainly was willing to go along with it, with an agreement with Japan. The Chinese were adamantly opposed, and Chiang Kai-shek sent this message saying he would consider it a total refutation of the relationship. He couldn't believe this would be happening. The Chinese people will go into retreat. The Japanese, the Chinese army will be dispirited, and this will not be. This was a veiled threat, really. The loss will not be to China alone, which will mean that, you know, it'll cost you a lot too.
Yeah.
So that when Hull got this from Chiang Kai-shek, and Chiang Kai-shek simultaneously lobbied all of the people in Washington that he could think of, and they had a powerful lobby, and a lot of it had to do with Madam Chang's brother, who was well connected around Washington. They were contacting everybody that they could think of to torpedo this agreement, and they leaked to the press that this was going to be an appeasement of the Japanese. Now, at that particular time, appeasement had a very nasty connotation because of the appeasement that had been made to Hitler 2 years earlier. So Hull was just shattered by this turn of events, and he felt that he could not then deliver the agreement that Chiang Kai-shek had objected to. And so he had to substitute another agreement. The other agreement was really a long-term goal, a set of goals that would follow along from the short-term modus vivendi. And this was a set of goals that would be achieved over a period of years, which involved the Japanese withdrawing from all of Indochina, all of China, and bear in mind that the Japanese army was bogged down in China. They were looking for a way out. And so this could have been accomplished over a period of time. Question was, you know, would they be asked to withdraw from Manchuria? And then what about Taiwan, which was theirs also, which was unspoken in the agreement, but would have been raised at a certain point. And it required the agreement of all of the parties, that including the Chinese, the British, the Dutch, even Thailand was a party to this so-called agreement, which could never be accomplished in the short period of time that was then the situation. There was a deadline here when they were down to the wire. It was a matter of a week to get an agreement. And that substituted agreement, which Hull then gave to the Japanese, was viewed as an ultimatum. And we had Pearl Harbor 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
Really, Japan torpedoed the whole thing. But war was not inevitable until then.
Yeah.
There were people that say months earlier, you know, when the Japanese went to this other part of Indochina, if they vary, when Tojo took power, this made war inevitable. It was not inevitable until the 26th of November, 1941.
It seemed like on the Japan side, the people in diplomacy, they knew that there were some hardline elements of their military. There's some moments where their army was kind of, they perceived the actions of the Americans one way. And so I thought that was fascinating. They were trying, they kept urging for meetings and to talk things over, like urgently, like this is important. Like it didn't seem like the U.S. perceived how their actions were being felt in Japan.
That's right. We did not. Hull, Stimson, Knox, they did not understand. They were decrypting all of the Japanese messages that were going from Tokyo into their embassy. They saw the urgency, and they were getting these messages from Ambassador Gru. Ambassador Gru was saying the Japanese will not back down in the face of pressure.
Going to moving over to Pearl Harbor, I had a couple questions. You detail this in the book, and it was just kind of, I made some underlined passages. You know, the United States is completely caught off guard, even though in the book, Rue even mentions in a telegram from like January earlier that year that there's been some talk of a planned attack on Pearl Harbor. They thought it was probably maybe going to be in the Western Pacific. After the Japanese catch the Americans by surprise, some of the actions that the Japanese fleet does is kind of head scratching. A, they don't refuel and attack. And then B, after Pearl Harbor, they leave for the Indian Ocean. I did not know that. You want to talk about, or wonder why those actions were taken. Were they just happy with the initial, or I couldn't quite figure out why it seemed like they could inflict even more damage and sort of put the United States in a complete bind. But do you want to speak to that and offer your insight into why the Japanese kind of, you know, acted the way they did after Pearl Harbor?
Well, there's two parts to this. Why did they break off as early as they did? They have stayed in the area, perhaps sunk two of our carriers had they stayed in the area. That's possible. There's talk about if they'd made more attacks, they would have lost a lot of airplanes. But they could have done other things. They could have looked for we had one carrier in the immediate area, the Enterprise, which searched south of Pearl Harbor based on false information. Had they gone north, they might have found the six carriers of the Japanese. In another day, they would have been in contact, and it might not have been a very good outcome for Enterprise.
Yeah.
Lexington was a day steaming away, and they would have joined the battle, I'm sure. So that all of that could have happened. That's the immediate question about Pearl Harbor. After that, the Japanese carriers went back to Japan. Two of them diverted off to support the Wake invasion, but basically they all went back to Japan. Then they went south, supported the invasion in one of the islands, and then went all the way to Darwin and attacked Darwin, and then from there went into the Indian Ocean. So they were in the Indian Ocean for 2 months, which allowed our carriers to rampage all through the Pacific. What was Yamamoto thinking about? He might have thought, well, maybe it was a good idea to interrupt the supply lines going into the Burma Road. But it doesn't seem logical to me. And I don't know that anybody has raised this question of why did Yamamoto leave the Pacific when he was involved in a war with the most dangerous adversary, which was the United States. If he had kept his carriers in the Pacific, he would have been fighting Halsey. He would have been, we probably couldn't have carried out a raid against Marcus. We probably couldn't have carried out the Doolittle raid. Who knows what could have happened? But I don't understand why Yamamoto abandoned the Pacific Ocean, having just gotten into a war with the most dangerous adversary. And I don't know anybody that's raised this question. It's all in diplomats and admirals. I raise it, but I'd be interested in hearing what other people think about this.
It was really kind of fascinating. You do a good job of kind of drawing a portrait of Yamamoto. Kind of, the book starts with Roosevelt and it's kind of contrasted with Yamamoto's origins. Yeah. And you do make a point, I didn't know this, Yamamoto was a bit of a gambler.
A deal with? A dilettante?
Yamamoto was a bit of a gambler.
Yeah, like, he was.
Yeah.
He had the reputation for being an absolutely brilliant poker player. He played bridge and poker and chess better than most good players. He had said, as it's recorded, if I weren't in the Navy, I'd be a professional gambler and I'd make a fortune.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's just a bit of
a guy. You know, it's too bad he didn't survive the war in some ways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is there, thinking to kind of Roosevelt and America, at the time there's not an urge, obviously, to get into another world war. Is there a line of thinking that they were you mentioned in the book, for whatever reason, Hull and some of the people in the cabinet thought that it would be an easy war against Japan, even though that the military said otherwise. Is there a line of thinking that they were looking for any way to get into the war to kind of overcome the isolationists in America? So if they got into a war with Japan, then they would get into a war with Germany. Is there any line of thinking that they thought that was their way to get in, to sort of get boots on the ground? Or
Roosevelt thought that sooner or later we're going to have to get in the war with against Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
The European nations couldn't stand up against Hitler. And even when Hitler invaded Russia in June of 41, for several months, it looked like, you know, Hitler was just going to roll over Russia the way he rolled over Belgium and Netherlands and France. So Roosevelt and Hitler wasn't really stopped until December of 41 outside Moscow. And even then, he was perceived to have plenty of power left. Mm-hmm. Some people would say that was the turning point of the war, but it was not clear at the time. So Roosevelt thought that we're going to have to get into this war. And that's laid out in Diplomats and Admirals. He thought we were going to have to get into this war. But the idea was, fight Hitler, don't fight the Japanese. And when the Japanese did attack, that created a huge problem, because suddenly we were at war with Japan and not with Hitler. So we could have been stuck just fighting Japan, which would have drawn resources away from what would have been forces against Hitler. Hitler solved the problem 4 days later by declaring war against us. So there we were in the two ocean war, which would then became the 8 or 9 month Navy war, because we had no way of landing troops anywhere. That was our situation.
It's a pretty interesting historical what if. Had some sort of settlement been agreed, we didn't have to fight a two-front war and just concentrate on the European theater. It's fascinating. And your book does a good job of like raising those questions.
Well, there's a lot more detail in the book, but that's the essence of it.
Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, we move along to kind of brings us to Midway.
Okay.
Which was that was a very well done part of the book.
I'm the first person that has deduced that Nimitz had a plan to meet the Japanese fleet early in the morning on the 4th of June. We had broken the code. We knew they were coming. And Nimitz had several things to consider. Number one, the range of the Japanese planes, the operating range was 240 miles. Ours was 175 miles. That's a difference of 65 miles. So Nimitz had to have a plan, or ideally would have a plan, that would get our carriers into our operating range before that they were discovered by the Japanese, who could execute an attack with planes that could fly out 240 miles. So that's the way to do that, was to have our carriers close the range early in the morning under darkness conditions, so that they could get within 175 miles before they were discovered. And he did that with an early morning plan for the 4th of June. So he had another couple of considerations. One, having broken the Japanese code and having known their attack plan, half of their planes were going to be launched at 240 miles out to attack the island of Midway, which meant that if we could launch an attack against the Japanese carriers, while those planes were away, we would be meeting, we would be met by only half of the Japanese reserve force, which was a huge advantage. So putting all that together, Nimitz had a plan for a concentration of force. The planes from Midway would fly up the reverse of the Japanese, and I lay this out in a diagram in the book. They would fly up the reverse of the Japanese course, which was 135, a southeast course. The carriers would be perpendicular to the Japanese course, and the scouting planes, the PBYs, would fly up the course, leaving at 0430 in the morning, find the Japanese carriers, having had confirmation the day before that the amphibious fleet was on course, so that they everything looked like everything was going to fall into place exactly as the Japanese had planned it. The PBYs found the Japanese carriers 175 miles out. The planes from Midway were to take off immediately when they got the word, which is about 0600. The word came in at 0603. And the carriers, and they'd meet the Japanese at 140 miles out. The carriers were perpendicular to that. They would launch their planes from 140 miles away, and there'd be a concentration of force over the Japanese carriers. A concentration of force is something that every military commander wants to achieve. As I say in the book, from the time Hannibal concentrated elephants to break the Roman lines, whether it's army commanders, navy commanders, you want a concentration of force. And that's that was the Nimitz plan. And it didn't work because the carriers were out of position, 60, 70 miles away. They were beyond their operating range of 175 miles. They were 200 miles away, and they were, the concentration of force had failed. So Spruance was detached, and he had to come up with a new plan to intercept the Japanese carriers. There was no backup scouting because Nimitz thought that all the scouting that was necessary would execute the discovery of the Japanese fleet, and they would execute the concentration of force. When that failed, there was no scouting left, so that Spruance had to consider a new interception course. And all he knew to do was to do the dead reckoning, assuming the Japanese carriers would maintain course and speed. He had to get to 175 miles. Well, from 200 miles to 175 miles, at 25 knots in a carrier takes an hour to do that. So he had to plot a new interception course, allowing for the carriers to move that distance in that period of time. So he had to have interception course further south, and he launched planes from Enterprise and planes from Hornet under separate command, two separate air group commanders. It turns out that with the delays involved, they were to cross the interception point about 9:25, which they proceeded to do. The Hornet commander thought, well, they're not here. All we're seeing is open ocean. So he thought maybe they were between us and Midway, and he turned south and east to try to intercept them there. They weren't there. The Enterprise commander, Lieutenant Commander McCluskey, thought, look, we had these planes from Midway attacking. They probably had to take evasive maneuvers to do that. They are probably further back on the dead reckoning course. So he retraced the Dead Reckoning course backward, flew for about 20 minutes and thought, okay, they're not here. And so where could they be? They probably aren't south of us. Their scouts might have found our carriers by this time. So let's do a search to the north. He started executing the search to the north and then saw the Japanese destroyer heading northeast. He thought, okay, we'll follow that Japanese destroyer. And by this time, they're really running low on fuel, really low. They could have turned back to save the planes that were low on fuel. They could have turned back even earlier than this. We'll follow that destroyer, and if we don't find them, find the fleet, the carriers, we got to go back to the Enterprise. Well, it turns out they found the Japanese carriers, and he had two squadrons of dive bombers. He assigned a squadron to each of two Japanese carriers and destroyed them. At the same time, Yorktown, by this time, had recovered their scouting. They had found the other two Japanese carriers. They had only one dive bomber squadron with that air group, which proceeded to destroy the third Japanese carriers. Their torpedo planes came in and attacked the fourth carrier, but the Japanese Zeros shot down the torpedo planes, and the fourth Japanese carrier survived for a few more hours. But that was the immediate events of 10:25 in the morning. To have gotten this victory, we're all going to watch the Super Bowl on Sunday. The Nimitz plan had failed. This was like Patrick Mahomes, 15 yards behind this line of scrimmage, dodging linebackers, and he throws a Hail Mary into the end zone, and it's caught. That was the win at Midway.
That was fascinating. We got like four. We wound up getting four of their carriers, but we almost didn't find them. It was almost.
It was a fluke. Yeah. If the Yorktown would have found one carrier, let's suppose that McCluskey had said, we can't find them, we got to head back. If he had done that, they would have destroyed the Yorktown planes. Let's say, assume they would have destroyed one carrier. They had three other carriers, including the largest one, the Kaga, ready to launch an attack. And that would have been pretty deadly.
Yeah.
In the title of the book, or is heroic deeds is mentioned. And when I was reading that section, I kept thinking, you know, from the planes taking off from Midway to sort of the extra search for the carriers, I just kept thinking, you know, these guys are the fumes, and they're just, it was, you know, kind of a stroke of luck that they found them, but just the sort of, it was pretty close to not, you know, not being a victorious battle. So it's a fascinating part of the book where you detail that. It's just, it's riveting, you know, kind of what happens, but the details of it are kind of amazing. So,
yeah. You see, with a big victory like that, and of course the fourth carrier was sunk later in the day, the Enterprise flyers took care of the fourth carrier. So it was a total victory. Why didn't anybody say anything about the Nimitz plan that it failed? Well, when you've got the big victory anyway, well, you know, nobody's going to come along and say, well, they didn't do it right, or they screwed up the plan. Nimitz was not going to say anything. Yeah. We had this great victory. So, you know, the Hail Mary went into the end zone. Game one.
People don't criticize Mahomes because he didn't follow the script if it works. Yeah.
So does Midway also, because going into Midway, it's, you know, experienced, you know, combat pilots in the Japanese versus seemingly sort of unexperienced, you know, pilots on the American side. Is there a sense of confidence that grows from Midway throughout the war? Because it seems kind of improbable, because the Japanese have seemingly better planes and more experienced fighters. Growing from Midway, does obviously the loss of the carriers is huge, but is there a sense that the American fighting force is becoming more, obviously. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Oh, this was a major boost for the carrier pilots. They had gotten some experience at Coral Sea, although there were losses. But a lot of those guys came and flew at Midway. The tactics of the Zero fighters, which were formidable planes, were analyzed, and the Zeros had tremendous climbing speed. And the word was, well, don't try to out-climb a Zero. If you can get above them, that's your best bet. Don't try to out-climb them. So the experience was being built up. Japanese still had potent forces. There were battles. We lost two carriers later on, the Wasp and the Hornet, at Midway, the Hornet being somewhat some distance away. But here again, it's worth pointing out that even in the 6 months of battle at Guadalcanal, which was a great source of pride for the Marine Corps, that's one something they do cite with great pride, and they should. But offshore Guadalcanal, there were six major naval battles going on over that six-month period, which most people aren't aware of. The Japanese were trying to supply their troops. We were trying to supply our troops. We were trying to prevent the Japanese from doing that, and vice versa. And there were, in the course of six major naval battles offshore Guadalcanal, we sank 25 Japanese ships. They sank about the same number of our ships. These were major battles. The Japanese had advanced torpedoes, and they took a heavy toll with their destroyers and cruisers launching torpedoes. This is another thing. We were not really in the land battles of World War II until 1943, with the exception of a six-month bogged down fight in Guadalcanal and landings in Morocco, which they took place, but we weren't really in that war until we invaded Sicily in 1943. Yeah. It was basically a Navy war all that time.
Did the victory at Midway, kind of the Japanese knew that the Americans had this manufacturing might, that sort of, once you get a victory, you can kind of, instead of, replacing what you've lost, you can kind of build on what, on your gains. Does that kind of, going forward, does the Navy become more kind of a potent force just because of the military, or
Roosevelt realized that he had to do a major rebuilding, and this took place starting in June of 1940, when Hitler overran France. That gave him the backing to have a major naval building program in effect. But those ships were not going to join the fleet for at least 2 years. The first ships that were in the Pacific, the Essex class carriers, were not there until the fall of 1942. All of the Coral Sea and Midway were fought with the existing ships we had. But having just done all that, the carriers started coming one after the other, and the Japanese were just overwhelmed. And the four carriers they lost at Midway were just irreplaceable.
Yeah.
They still had forces left, but they were defenders after that. And they were inevitably going to lose.
Yeah, that was the breaking point. That's when they had lost. It didn't end right away, but once they lost Midway, and they kind of knew it too, didn't they? They had game plan for we can't keep up with America's industrial might.
No, they didn't. That was one of the reasons that the analysis, one of the disclosures that the analysis made earlier in 1941, you can't win. And that's what happened.
Yeah. One last question for me. Once the war with Japan starts, is there any, do they ever try back channel diplomacy? Does Japan, when it's done the kind of research, it knows I think that the thing said you might win a couple early battles, but overall you're going to lose. Was there any notion that they could reach a settlement before the war kind of dragged on for another couple of years? Was there ever an attempt at a kind of a second chance at diplomacy, or was it just that was kind of off the table once the...
Oh, I don't know. I think once you get to that point of war, it's pretty difficult to stop.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, Roosevelt made a powerful speech before Congress, the Day of Infamy speech. And it just said, we are in this war to win, mm-hmm. and we're going to do it. And there was no turning back after that. And as a matter of fact, it's significant because Roosevelt was able to drop a curtain right then and there on the 8th of December. Everything going forward is war. Nobody ever said, well, what happened? You know, didn't you guys, didn't you diplomats have warnings? Didn't you, you know, was anybody culpable? Well, they blamed it on the admiral and the general in Pearl Harbor. But nobody has ever gone back and said to Hull, you know, why didn't you have an agreement with Japan? Why was this opportunity blown? Hmm. Nobody seems to have ever done that. I lay it out with the documents. And a lot of these things were classified for a long time. But my footnotes show these are foreign policy of the United States diplomatic papers. These are available for anybody now. Hmm. That message from Chiang Kai-shek is in... It is in the foreign policy documents.
Really?
Hmm. Was that recently declassified?
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
Oh, the Chiang Kai-shek memo. Had that been recently declassified?
They've been declassified over a period of time.
Okay.
I went to the archives in College Park, Maryland. And you see like Nimitz's action report from the Battle of Midway, dated June 15, 1942, 11 days after the battle. Hmm. It was classified secret. And then you see on it a declassified with a code number, but there's no date on that.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
I'm sure that people want to dig into this, they can get a date, but a lot of these things were secret. The document I saw had Nimitz's original signature on it, C.W. Nimitz in blue ink. And the disclosures, the attachments were action reports from the task force commanders, the squadron commanders, ship captains, and so forth. There are about nine attachments to Nimitz's action report, which I quoted from in the book, the squadron commanders from Enterprise, but two squadron commanders from Enterprise were Dick Best and Earl Gallagher. They're quoted in the book.
Yeah, all the memos and everything like that for people listening in the book, it's just fascinating to read. They got kind of actual source material in that. So it's you get a really good in-depth view of everything. So that's one of my favorite things about the book was the, I like the inclusion of the fireside chats. I don't know why Roosevelt's thing. I always find that fascinating that he had these. And they're kind of interesting to read now, but all those elements to the book I really appreciate and liked. So,
yeah.
Matt, do you have a final question or two?
It's not so much a question as a praise, but I really, one of the things I really appreciated about the book, you have an eye for kind of the dramatic detail. Just what really stuck with me is, I believe it was Admiral Nagumo at Midway. He was a battleship guy. He kind of made his bones being captain of a battleship, and he didn't really know carriers, but he had two staff members who would kind of bail him out, and they knew carrier battles and everything. And on the day of Midway, those two guys just happened to be sick. And it just kind of the worst timing for Nagumo, and just the drama of that, I thought was really well captured. Those little things to kind of make or break a big event.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
It could have been different. He had, Nagumo had an opportunity to attack even after he, you know, the Midway flyers caused him to panic, and he started rearm his planes differently. And then their scouting report came in about 15 minutes later, and he dawdled for 15 minutes. So by this time, it's 7:45. It's 7:45. Part of his planes were in being in the middle of rearmament. But he still had a significant force, and he could have launched an attack at 7:45, even though the planes coming back from Midway were coming at 8:30. He had time to get an attack off, even though the Marine pilots from Midway, Henderson, they came in at 0800. The Zeros shot them down. That was not a serious impediment. Nagumo could have gotten off an attack with about 64 planes and could have done some serious damage. And it would have allowed the planes coming back from Midway to rearm. Mm. He didn't do that. So that was, you know, major, major mistake. Lost opportunity.
Yeah. And his right-hand men who would be in his ear telling him, hey, maybe we have an opportunity here. One was delirious with a fever, and one had just had an appendectomy.
Appendicitis.
Appendicitis, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there. It's the little things, yeah. It's
those things. Yeah.
Incredible.
The hand of God.
Yeah. Well, Dale, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I think Matt and I have both learned a lot. The book is fantastic. Diplomats and Admirals by Dale Jenkins. It's you can buy it. You can buy it on Amazon. You can probably order it at your used bookstore. It's a fascinating account of diplomacy and then the battles of Midway and kind of the background of Pearl Harbor, Coral Sea. It's for World War II history buffs or, you know, experts, you know, or kind of people new to World War II history. I highly recommend this book. So I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast to talk about it.
Well, it's been interesting for me too.
Hey, real quick, while we have you, we're recording this the Thursday before the Super Bowl, and you mentioned it. Just who do you like in the game this Sunday?
I'm sorry, to liken it to the Super Bowl?
Oh, no. Who do you like in the Super Bowl, Chiefs or Eagles?
Who do I like? Oh, I don't know. You have two great teams. The quarterbacks are both great. They have a different style. Yeah. You know, Mahomes is one of a kind, but the Eagles are just a fighting machine with no flaws that I can see, having followed them along somewhat. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, should be a fun game. Yeah,
it could be a Hail Mary that wins it at the end.
That would be amazing. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Dale. You know, best of luck. I know you're doing some more speaking engagements, and best of luck on those. And hopefully a lot of people buy the book because it's definitely worth it. So
okay, all right.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, thank you.